Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Stomp TV podcast. It's an honor you're listening to this. My name is Jason Wise. I'm the director of the films, the creator of this insane streaming platform, and the lack of brains behind all this stuff. So let's get right into this. This show today, I'm going to talk to Brian McClintic. Brian McClintic is not just a person who's been in all three of the films so far, but he's also one of my very dear friends. I've known Brian since well before I was a filmmaker and before he was a sommelier, and so we go way back. I wanted to talk to Brian about natural wine. I know this is a topic people are either all they want to hear is about natural wine or they're sick and tired of hearing about natural wine. I see both sides of that. I don't think it's ever going to truly be defined, but Brian and I sit down and try, you know, Brian has gotten very much into the path of natural wine recently in the last, say, 4 years. I think he's uniquely positioned to give his opinion on kind of what it means and what it means in today's world and why it's important. And we'll also catch up sort of where he is in life right now. That's I think, something that should be talked about often in the wine business is anything that appears to be a fad, we should continually talk about what it is, why people don't like it, what the problems are, and try to define it. So we'll talk about natural wine on today's podcast. But before that, this week on Somm TV, we have a new episode of Verticals. We're going to go with Carlo Mondavi into his family's name. He's going to open up several bottles of wine, go back through the history with Krug and his grandfather who started Mondavi, and we open up some pretty stellar stuff. It's been a long time coming for this episode, so I'm really excited about it. We also have Sabato Segaria, who is a master sommelier who's been in the films. He's going to do the very first, we'll call it an educational experience, and there are tons and tons coming to Somm TV. This one is about Sangiovese, the grape, where it's from, what wines it's in, and that is coming up as well. So that's probably live as you're listening to this, or it will be up this Thursday. I have a feature film called The Delicacy that I've been making for 5 years. It premieres in, at the time of this recording, 8 days in Santa Barbara International Film Festival. That's the 24th of January at 8:40 p.m. in a big theater. It's been a long, long time coming. I'm extremely excited. I just got back from Nashville recording with a full orchestra. So it's the first film I've ever done that has a full orchestral score. You know, you're going to hear a lot about this on the podcast because I don't have anyone else to talk to, just you guys. I'm really excited for this movie. It's above and below water, the whole deal. It's quite an experience as far as I don't think there have been many food films done in this capacity. So hopefully you guys will enjoy that, and I'm sure reviews and things will start coming out about that movie, and release information is going to be coming very soon. Before my interview, we should talk a little bit about the next Somm movie. Yes, there is another Somm film coming. I suppose we should talk a bit about it, why I made it. No spoilers what it is, but I decided that, as many of you in the wine world know, it's a bottomless pit. You can't even touch the sides of the pit, let alone the bottom. And, you know, if you're having fun like I am, you kind of just want to keep digging too, which is the problem. And so this particular movie, I think it was what I wanted to do instead of Somm 2, which was Into the Bottle. This one is going to, I'll just give one little bit about what it's about, and it's going to go very deep into the origins of wine, but using a very modern story. And it's a pretty remarkable situation. One, that we were able to film what we were able to film, and two, that, you know, we were able to pull it off. We still have a little bit more to go, but there will be some very special engagements at the end of this summer in the United States, and then it will start to roll out. We're going to do a fairly large release of this film, and I think it deserves it. So I really, really I want to hear from you guys on what your thoughts are for a fourth film in this series, and I just, you know, very looking forward to getting that out. And I appreciate very much you guys listening to the podcast. Without further ado, here is my interview with Brian McClintic. Brian, what have you been up to? If anybody follows Brian on Instagram or anything, he's got long hair and a beautiful beard. He looks very different.
Yeah, I haven't washed my hair in a while. I have been living out of a suitcase since February, which is incredibly exciting. And I think I'm kind of heading towards the end of that era. So I'm actively looking for vineyard land up in Oregon, and we'll see what happens. But yeah, that would be awesome to get my fingers in the dirt and start to plant a little roots after going all over Christendom.
So you want to make wine? Yeah.
I want to kind of create a test kitchen for regenerative agriculture. So have really no interest in making wine, but definitely experimenting with different farming systems and planting a vineyard from seed potentially.
I'm, you know, just speaking as somebody on the outside, that sounds incredibly unprofitable.
Oh, yeah. No, this is like nothing that you'd ever want to invest in. I specialize in terrible investment ideas. And so how I end up with any money to fund these things is news to me. But I'm probably going to try to secure some sort of a loan and, you know, dump it all into a raw piece of land. And
If anybody's out there really looking to invest a large sum of money into a bad investment, Brian has a great idea for that.
Right.
No, it's honestly what you're talking about is a very endlessly fascinating thing to me that you want to. What he's talking about here is taking a piece of land and planting a vineyard from seed.
These are the explorations. And the problem is, like, you know, depending on how you do this, you don't know how long it's going to take for a vine to come up. So the waiting game, so if you plant a vineyard from scratch conventionally, it might cost, let's say, $50,000 to $100,000, and you're waiting 3 years for that vine to actively fruit for the most part. And so this might be a 7-year wait. Some might take longer, but you actually don't have a lot of upfront costs. So what you need is time.
Well, land is not cheap, I mean.
So that would be part of it. It would be like, you know, five acres of that, but we'd really experiment with other ideas, like maybe not planting in rows, maybe wrapping them around orchard trees or just different aspects of
that's interesting.
Ideas. It's almost like an art installation. What can be done? So there's a lot of interesting ideas out there in the permaculture world, and people like Nate Reddy from HiU are already doing this,
right,
and moving in this direction. And so for me to do something that's non-commercial, while also the property I'm looking at right now is 120 acres, so I don't need that much land, but it was clear cut by a timber company. So to bring back, you know, the woodland forest, potentially use grazing animals to help thin the forest and add a beneficial aspect to the vineyard by, you know, breaking up the soil, creating what Nate calls like different fertility events, where you're actually, you know, obviously the manure.
Yeah, you can see this is why I want to follow this, because I mean, obviously I'm incredibly interested in the unknown, meaning,
right,
and this is a great unknown. I'm also pretty interested in obsession, and you are somebody who doesn't half-ass stuff. You basically, you know, you go all in. I've seen it. I made a movie about you.
The area that I'm looking at is a really precious area.
Well, we're going to cover this in a future podcast, yeah, but I just want to, this is where Brian is right now. Brian is working very hard, very attached to land and the environment and his incredibly beautiful locks of hair. You should see these things. I wish you guys could see how, I mean, honest to God, you look like I'm trying to think like what the comparison I would give. Like if Paul Walker had really long hair, it's kind of how I feel you look right now.
Wow, that's an honor.
Yeah, that's how I feel.
Thank you for that.
Okay.
I was going for that.
I think when you do turn this around and get this piece of land, which I'm sure you'll get, this is going to be a fantastic thing to watch happen. I cannot wait. Though please make some wine too. Don't just experiment with farming.
Oh no, I'm just gonna farm, man. It's gonna be great. We'll make some wine for sure. But yeah, just imagine. Anyways, we'll get into another podcast. But it's a to be continued situation.
Love it.
Yeah.
All right, Mr. McClintic, let's talk about something that I always feel is just like a gigantic slippery slope of a conversation.
Yes. Natural wine.
Natural wine. I want to talk about this because I think it is the weirdest. It's the strangest thing in the wine world for me at the moment because it is so maligned for no reason. I mean, it's beat up in a way that's not fair, but it's also held up in a way that's completely not fair. People stand behind natural wine like it's some kind of vitamin or something. I mean, like they're just like, it's going to help you and cure you. And then other people act like it is this sour poison. And I don't understand why either of those forces exist, because it just makes no sense. I mean, I happen to, and I say this, I happen to truly enjoy a lot of what are called natural wines.
Right.
I never got them because they were called a natural wine.
Right.
So how do we even start a conversation about defining what the F a natural wine is and why you should try one, and if you didn't like it, try another one, or why you should never try one again. I don't even know. What is natural wine? Can you tell me?
One of the major problems is this is a moniker that's stuck, and there isn't real clear-cut definition as to what natural wine is. So if you look at it historically, this was a movement And oftentimes when people talk about natural wine, they talk about it from a sensory experience.
Are we talking recent? Because, I mean, obviously natural wine as a concept was just wine for a long time. I mean, thousands
Correct.
Of years they just made
Correct.
Wine.
This is definitely a future like, primitive back to the future situation where, you know, and it was. It was an attempt in the very onset of the modern definition, or not definition, but the modern history, let's say, of natural wine, of returning back to more primitive ways of...
Hold on, let's take a step back, because here are the three or four terms that I think we have to define before we can even talk about natural wine. There's organic wine.
Right.
Is organic wine natural wine?
Organic wine, if you talk to where natural wine started, is the beginning.
Okay. There's biodynamic wine. Is biodynamic wine natural wine?
No.
Okay.
No. But certainly that it could fold into the umbrella. So if you look at it like this, natural wine has come to define a group of organic / biodynamic producers who have very, very minimal intervention, if any, in the winemaking process. And the kind of laughable irony of that is the whole process of growing grapes and making wine is incredibly unnatural to begin with. You're basically taming a vine to your will and fermenting it in multiple different vessels. So,
but if in fairness, if you put a bunch of grapes in a bucket, they're going to ferment on their own.
Correct.
So in fairness, the actual fermentation of grapes, that would happen if they fell
Absolutely.
In a pile. That's
Absolutely.
Not that
unnatural. Now, I think most industrial wine, you would throw synthetic yeast in there to start that fermentation and control it. So here's one additive in the winemaking process.
And yeast is the thing that creates the alcohol, correct?
Right.
Okay. So,
and so this is one additive in the winemaking process that if you fermented a wine naturally, just allowing the yeast in the vineyard or in whatever biome you're fermenting the wine, whatever that cave or winery is.
So hold on. We're going to try to baby step through all this stuff. So yeast, where is the yeast if you do it naturally? You're digging it out of the soil and adding it?
It exists in the vineyard. It exists on your body. It exists ambiently in the cellar that you're fermenting.
Okay. The reason I want to get that out is because I find it, some of these terms are so confusing to the normal person. You go native yeast and all this stuff. And I mean,
everyone,
when you think of yeast, I mean, I think maybe this is just me, but you think of bread.
Right.
You know, that's your only time you're really in contact with yeast from like I'm dealing with yeast on a normal basis as a person. I mean, winemakers, why would you ever add yeast if it exists on the grapes, if it exists on the plants, if it exists everywhere? Why would you add it? What's the point?
To control fermentation, because if you just rely on what's ambient, you don't always know what you're going to get. So fermentations could get stuck, let's say, and you'll have a really hard time converting sugar to alcohol. So people like control, and especially in the New World, the thought has been, can we control this process so we can create a very specific, consistent product that tastes a certain way? What you sacrifice, because there's always plus and minus with decisions and inputs in the winemaking process, what you sacrifice is potentially terroir and some of the interesting aspects that naturally would have occurred not only in your cellar, but in the vineyard.
If you add some non-native yeast.
Exactly.
Okay.
And then there's the aspect of what are these additives beyond yeast? I mean, how egregious does it get when we're talking about mega purple, when we're talking about Velcrin?
Adding dyes, you're talking about
Velcrin, there's, you know, if you have a fruit like Gatorade and it's on the shelf and it's not refrigerated, you're like, well, why is that fruit stable? That's Velcrin. That's administered in a hazmat suit until it precipitates out because it's lethally toxic. But once it precipitates out, it stabilizes a beverage. And so people do that in the winemaking process. And so there's all sorts of war crimes that are unenforced because there's no ingredients on a label. So natural wine is kind of used as a poster child for additive-free wine.
Right. But I mean, I know people who use a tiny bit of sulfur in parts of their winemaking.
Exactly.
I think... I don't want to call him out, but I think Raj uses some occasionally. And
so here's,
if you ask
here's,
him, he says, yeah. I believe my wine is natural.
I mean, and here's where the arguments start to arise. There are a lot of what a lot of people would consider natural wines that have small amounts of sulfur as a preservative. And then there are diehard people who are like, no, you have to go 00. I mean, we should also note that sulfur in the winemaking process is a derivative of oil refineries. So when we start to like really explore—
Always? Really?
Yes. So when we start to—
But they've used sulfur since the Roman times to preserve wine. I mean, you can find sulfur.
You can. Too. And then there's, so if you want to look at alternative forms of sulfur, there's volcanic sulfur. But a lot of the ethical practices volcanic sulfur is mined raises completely other human.
I've seen it in Bolivia. It's pretty rough.
Right.
Yeah, it's
so
terrible.
Yes, there are other forms of sulfur. And so I think these conversations as to just like you're asking where your food comes from, understanding a lot of these processes so you know what additives and where they come from is—
Well, so now all of a sudden we're talking about something different.
It's easy to get into a rabbit hole.
Oh, yeah. So you start with what does the wine taste like and is natural make wine taste better or taste worse or make me feel better or feel worse? And then all of a sudden we're talking about the environment.
Yeah. So let me tell you my experience with natural wine, which was much more anecdotal. I had experiences with certain wines that I just loved. Why is this wine so fresh? Why does it have this like energetic, probiotic, like almost like kombucha-like energy in the wine? I would taste this and didn't really understand what it was. And in almost every instance, it was a quote-unquote natural wine. So in 2015, I went to my first natural wine tasting in Arles. And I'm like, I've got to like really get into this and understand it. And I would say 99.9% of those wines were absolutely undrinkable.
Wow. That's
You put them in your mouth and they're seriously flawed beyond all recognition. And by the way, I'm tolerant of certain flaws. But when it just becomes this completely neglectful process of like, allowing wine to just work itself out and bottling without any intention or thought, the lines get blurred between hands off and neglect.
Well, so here's, now this is just my bad analogy.
Okay.
It's like, you look at like winemaking is like making a film and you have a director and you have actors and you have a cameraman.
Yeah.
You have all these different components that come in, but you still have the director is not there, though they often are, and I often am a dick, to be a dick and just tell everybody what to do.
Mm-hmm.
The director's there to keep a unified voice. And I kind of look very much like the winemaker is the person who has to say, this is what we're going for. And everybody's input creates a broader... But the thing with a winemaker...
It's a lot more personal experience. You don't have a cat. You're not orchestrating a symphony as much. I mean, you might have people under you if it's a large-scale production, but you're interacting with the wine very personally, so you have a lot more control.
Right, but I mean, think about the natural wine situation. You're basically saying it has to be made at a tiny level because, you know, most wineries, they have a viticulturist, they have a vineyard manager, they have a winemaker, they have, you know, there are certain positions, whether or not they're involved the whole year, that exist that all have to kind of be on the same page. But if you're talking a natural winemaker where you're just, you know, what's called a father and son who are making... Or a daughter and a mom, and they're doing everything. Then their case production is not going to be very big. I mean, I wonder because oftentimes the natural wine moniker seems to fall on, they're tiny.
Yeah.
And there are some like Emilio Pepe is not a tiny winery.
No.
They're in Italy and they make quite a bit. So how are they a natural winemaker? This is the problem is like the definition of this is tough, and I know the wine business to some extent.
Then there's always greenwashing, right? We know that in the organic world. So now are larger scale wineries trying to capitalize on some of these monikers, and they're saying they're natural, and because it's non-codified, you know, what does that actually mean? So. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think for the most part, so if you look at the genesis of the modern history of natural wine, this started in the 50s with a guy named Jules Chauvet. And basically in the 70s, you know, 60s and 70s, like Beaujolais Nouveau became very popular.
Right.
And then it led to mechanization and stamping out this industrial product. And a lot of the people who were farming organically did not want to see this rise of technology. So it was
Beaujolais Nouveau, which full disclosure, I cannot stand. But that was like led to industrializing kind of Beaujolais?
There was that led to the natural wine movement.
Beaujolais Nouveau led to natural wine.
I think so. The mechanization and the industrial like movement that happened in Beaujolais, which is a very small rural place, left a few organic producers like kind of scratching their heads. So there was almost this rage against the machine movement where, okay, let's start with organic farming and then figure out if there's, with farming, there's less inputs. You're not spraying synthetic herbicides and pesticides in the vineyard. So there's always this mindset. So they started from this framework of organic farming. And if you're farming organically, you're not spraying synthetic herbicides and pesticides. You're actually trying to do less inputs. You're trying to encourage nature. You're trying to return to old ways of working. And that's going to spill over into the decisions you make in the cellar. You're probably not going to destroy terroir by all these additives that try to control the process and beat it into an industrial cocktail. So were there shades of gray in the natural wine community? Yeah, some people were slightly chaptalizing still. Some people were adding sulfur. Some people weren't. There were little micro inputs here and there. And then people can get ultra technical and militant with what's an additive, what's not an additive in this. And these are where all these like reductive infighting and civil wars happen with natural wine.
When we talk about what's added to wine, I don't want to get into the deep chemical stuff because I think anybody listening, this is smart enough to understand a chemical added to something is supposed to have some effect.
Right.
But there are certain things that, and it's tough to talk about chemicals because they require a great understanding of things that I'm not qualified to explain.
Right.
But there are certain things added to wine that I want to ask you, if they're added, is it natural? So like if I acidify, which means I'm trying to make the wine a little more tart, does that negate it from being a natural wine?
I think the majority of people in the natural wine community would not consider that that would be a cardinal sin.
So making my wine more acidic
by adding tartaric acid.
Right.
Would be considered a cardinal sin.
And tartaric acid is from grapes originally.
The majority of the natural wine community.
Tartaric acid is a derivative of grapes.
It is.
It comes from grapes. And on a scale of like the wineries of the world, let's talk about Burgundy. Burgundy's, do they acidify their wines? Some of the great wineries in the world? Does Bordeaux?
Heard that they do. Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay. So it's a common, relatively standard practice that if your wine ends up a little fat, you come back and you put some acid in it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. What about water? What if you add water to your wine, and why would you add water?
Certainly more of an issue, certainly more of a common practice in California. So a lot of times people were trying to chase this like really Parker heavy ripe style. And so what would end up happening is you'd have a wine that has a potential alcohol of, let's say, 18%. Well, yeast might die out at, let's say, 15%. So it's really hard to finish that fermentation without having a ton of sugar left in the wine. So you would add water to dilute the alcohol level so you could actually finish fermentation. And you're also adding volumetric liquid to the wine. So you're actually getting, it's like free gain in terms of what you're selling.
So you're
depending on how much water you're adding.
You're just making more volume.
Right.
Okay, so is that negate it from being a natural wine? Water's natural.
Oh, 100%. That would be a cardinal sin for natural wine producers.
Okay.
Absolutely.
What if I have red grapes and I don't have enough wine, but I have some white grapes and I want to add that together? I want to mix it and co-ferment it, meaning let them ferment together. Is that a natural wine?
Fermenting white grapes with red grapes?
Yeah, sure.
Is
I want to add more grapes that aren't supposed to be in there.
Absolutely, you could do that.
Okay. What about if I've already fermented a red wine and then a white wine and I want to mix those together afterwards and create a rosé? I could create a rosé from two wines that are done,
yeah,
and that would be a natural
wine.
What about if I were to bottle it in a can? Can it be a natural wine?
Sure.
What if I want to bottle it in a box with a plastic liner? Can that be a natural wine?
Sure.
Does the cork have anything to do with it being natural?
No.
So I could get a foam industrial cork and put it in the wine and it would be a natural wine.
I've not seen that happen, nor would I attest to its reliability, but Yeah, you could be the first, buddy.
Well, I'm just asking because I think
I see where you're going.
Megan Zilbach, do you know who she is?
Yes.
Yeah, I love her. And yeah. She's in a blind tasting sessions on Somme TV right now, and we have a thing coming out called the Sommelier's Dictionary, and we get into all these different terms and what they mean. And they asked her about natural wine, and her head almost exploded trying to define it. But she came up with a term that I thought was really interesting. She goes, there's natty wine, and there's natural wine. Mm-hmm. Term natural wine is a very important, sound, delicious thing. Mm-hmm. She works at a winery that makes natural wine.
Right.
She says natty wine, in her opinion, when people say that term, it is a very trendy, often flawed, it's like a buzz thing. Like I'm drinking natty wine. And I think that's an interesting way to look at it. Mm-hmm. Is like one's wine, one is can be, but it's often more of a term. You're selling something. You're selling like an organic, like, you know, here's the way organic as a term is the same way like HD was in video. It's like it doesn't really mean anything.
Right.
It means a resolution, which means it's still video, but it's not that not all HD is the same. Does that make sense?
It does, and I think the natural wine movement is a popular movement that is going to continue to gain steam. And so with that, opportunism happens, and the more the lines get blurred, because the lines were fairly blurred to begin with. I think the idea came from an idea of how can we work with less? How can we rewild our existence? How can we take less in our lives, take less in the vineyard from nature, and add less in the cellar? And as we start to explore these ideas, that's the really the important thing.
Yeah. What's Pet Nat?
Pet Nat is a sparkling wine that's fermented naturally in bottle. So you're not adding any stabilizers, clarifying agents. You're not doing the full method champenoise.
No dosage. You're not adding sugar.
Exactly.
You're not.
Exactly. And some of them are sweet and some of them ferment dry in the bottle. But
is that kind of how Lambrusco is done?
Oftentimes Pet Nat doesn't have any sulfur in it, no additives at all. It's just bottled up grape juice.
Okay, because you see Pet Nat, I happen to, some of them I think are disgusting and some I think are quite tasty.
That's the unpredictability.
Pascaline makes a really nice wine. Pet Nat.
I love her. Yeah.
Pascaline.
So in hybrid Paltea, grapes.
Yeah, she is a master sommelier in New York and she makes a Pet Nat. And I believe the grapes come from, is it New York State or no?
Yeah. It's I believe it's Finger Lakes.
Finger Lakes. Yeah. I mean, it's a tasty wine.
Yeah, I've had it several times visiting her. Yeah, there's a lot of really fun experimentation, especially in the New World, with it.
Yeah,
you know, and yeah, I'm really encouraged by people just knowing where stuff comes from, thinking about carefully about does this input need to happen, because you get into other stuff too. I mean, let's talk about the vegan wine, right? Because this is totally wrapped into it.
Interesting.
Traditionally, people.
It's another have, turn I didn't, a
have,
term I didn't
well,
think about.
Well, have fined before, and what are fining agents that you use in the winemaking process? So we think of like clarifying butter, right? People do this in the winemaking process, and it creates a very, very specific texture and creates kind of a more pristine, focused wine. But there are additives involved with fining, and some is bentonite, which is like a natural clay, but other people use fish bladders.
Or you use egg whites.
Right. And so for the
vegan fining just gets all the particles in the wine to adhere to something and fall to the bottom, correct?
Right.
Is that right?
Right. And I've done fining trials before in Champagne. I've done them with still wine in the New World. The difference with one small additive is immense.
So if I were to... Yeah,
one fining, just a little bit of a fining agent is a giant change, not only in flavor, but texture of mm-hmm, the wine. Mm-hmm. So
is that natural if I use a fining agent?
I think that there are some producers who lightly fine and filter that have street cred, in the natural wine community. But I think personally, they probably don't do it every vintage. And for my wine club, I don't like to fine or filter at all. So these are now requirements that are starting to be laid down with a lot of the collaborations, because I feel like the wine is significantly marked by that process and can be circumvented naturally. You know, the problem with filtration is the wine, you're afraid the wine's going to be cloudy, right?
Right.
And so if you just wait long enough in a cold enough environment, basically the wine will settle in and of itself, and you can have a clear enough beverage without sacrificing a lot of the character.
I don't think, you know, it's a strange thing. That's a totally unnecessary fear for people that drink. I mean, I've had tons of unfiltered wines that are delicious, and it makes no, in fact, I honestly prefer it to be not, I mean, that's, but.
The rubber really hits the road is when you actually taste a wine that's being filtered on both sides of it. So you taste it before it goes through the filtration device, and then you taste it on the other side.
That's interesting.
And I've done that.
And you prefer the unfiltered?
Oh, every time.
Yeah.
Every time. Like, the character will get stripped out of that wine. There will be loss. So.
Well, let me ask you this. So now, because we want to wrap this up, but let's talk about, say, 3 or 5 natural wines somebody should try, that they can try. Because one of the other issues is, I'm into wine. I live in Omaha, Nebraska, or I live in Cleveland, Ohio, or I live in, and you don't have the, or Hawaii or something, you don't have the ability to get a lot of these things. So you're on the outside looking at Twitter and people bitching at each other about what natural wine is or not. And people form opinions based on nothing.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the nature of humanity. We do that. But it's not, a lot of people don't get out there and get in the trenches and try stuff to form their opinion. Mm-hmm. They go, who do I respect that has an opinion?
And sure.
They attach, I do it too. Everybody does it.
Right.
But if you want to get yourself out there and try what natural wine is, can you recommend a few, maybe? Is that possible?
Yeah. I mean, I think that, first of all, I think the easiest thing for a consumer to do is to latch on either to a retailer, because you can ship. And even if you're in Hawaii, I have wine club members in Hawaii. So it's not easy. And shipping's tough, but we make it work, because I want people on the island to be exposed to stuff that is hard to get over there.
Well, what are some producers? Because I mean you have a wait list.
Well, I think it's really good to follow certain importers, because then you get to see all the wines in that importer's array. Like for instance, Jose Pastor, you know, has predominantly natural wine producers in his portfolio. And so if all you have to do is go to the website and look at those producers, and then go to Wine Searcher and Google, are these, any of these producers available in my area? I want to try them, you know? Go to your local restaurant and taste a natural wine. Ask for one to see if they have some, to get to know them. Talking about individual producers, there's just so many.
Right.
I mean, we can...
No, I just meant, I mean, I always fall back on this Emilio Pepe thing, because you can find,
right,
that is one of the
yeah,
very good wines of the world, and with a lot of history.
Yeah.
And they don't, there's nothing natural in their bottle. They just make natural wine. I mean, at least from a lot of people's definition,
sure,
they do.
Sure.
Are there any big producers like that make natural wine? I know Dutrev, right? Who you talk about in some too, and Into the Bottle.
Dutrev does make a fair amount of wine. He has 15 hectares, you know, which is like 25 acres.
Dutrev is a Beaujolais that, right, Brian mentions in Into the Bottle. That's natural, right?
That is very natural. But a lot of his stuff is allocated, and so, right, it's very hard to find in the United States. I think Loire Valley is probably the best bet. Number one, Chenin Blanc is a world-class grape. There's a lot of natural wine producers with Chenin and Cab Franc, and it's really well-priced.
Yeah.
So everything from, you know, Breton to Lambert, these are some of the more widely distributed Cab Francs and Chenin Blancs out there. Guy Berthaud is excellent. You know, it sounds like more name dropping again. But there's a ton of producers in that section, from Saumur to Anjou to Vouvray,
right.
And Malmedy.
So do you only drink natural wine, or do you drink?
I do. Now.
Only?
Yeah.
So, like, you wouldn't have a big Bordeaux with me right now?
Probably not.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's an interesting progression. I mean, it's funny. It's almost a cliche that sommeliers go from one point to the next point.
One of the things is I have a very narrow palate of what I like to drink. And natural wine, honestly, subjectively, I just enjoy drinking it. And I'm really careful about what I put in my system. And then there's the environmental impact.
I know that's a big thing for you, yeah.
Right. And so now it's, you know, with my company, it's supporting regenerative agriculture. I also, the other thing is I have a lot more, a very different relationship with flaws in wine, which could be an entirely different segment, but this is all tied in. Because a lot of people, the reason why they make all these inputs is because they're terrified of flaws. They're terrified of Britannomyces and volatile acidity and mouse and all these things that, you know, as you're coming up in the quartermaster sommeliers, these are flaws in wine. But, you know, I think Jamie Good has probably the best explanation in his book Flawless of this wabi-sabi idea, where slight amounts of imperfection actually make a wine more beautiful.
So some kind of character.
Right. I mean, we see this in the natural world. I mean, you could look at the Versailles in a manicured hedge, or you could look at the rugged, untamed imperfection of nature, and maybe both are beautiful, right? You look at modeling, there are certain features that are really symmetrical, but it's not totally symmetrical. If it was totally symmetrical, the person would look like this mannequin, weird, like, you know,
yeah, I get what
cyborg,
you're saying. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Right? Like, that's, you know, A-list actors.
I think models are often not chosen because they're beautiful. They're chosen because they're different.
Right, and they have a certain striking look, but a lot of that look is based on
imperfection. I know, I am a model, so I know this.
I'm a hand model, like George Costanza. I don't know if you knew that. I'm kind of bummed this isn't a video podcast.
I am too.
For both of us.
If people could see you in this unbelievable leotard you're wearing, this onesie.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Anyways.
But, yeah, his book, Flawless, there's a whole chapter that is dedicated to, you know, our relationship with flaws. And so it's an interesting read. And certainly certain amounts of Brett in certain capacities and certain amount of VA, I actually think make wine better.
That is a bold statement, my friend. I like that.
Yeah.
All right, well, I guess I'll end the podcast with telling people to try natural wine before you bitch about it, maybe. I mean, and then if you don't like it, try it again. This is the way life works. And then if you've tried it a few times and you still don't like it, great. More power to you. I mean, that's just the way human taste is supposed to be. You're not supposed to like everything, and there are supposed to be a few things you don't like. So,
I like you.
You do?
Yeah,
a lot. You really mean that?
I could have a steady diet of nothing but Jason Wise.
I am not natural, my friend.
Okay.
I am propped up by Spanx and silicone.
I take it all back.
It's good to talk to you, man. We need to do this more often. I love you, man.
Love you too, dude.
All right.
Thanks a lot.
What's your wine club website?
Oh, that. Viticolewine.com. V-I-T-I-C-O-L-E wine.com.
Thanks, everybody, for listening to the SomTV podcast. Brian's wine club, join it. It's called Vitical. They have offerings, and it is a pretty special thing. Brian hand selects and hand works with all the winemakers on all the cuvées. Really special project that he's working on. Please go to somtv.com, subscribe, check things out there. We have new content every week, and we have so much coming, including a lot of the feature films we talk about often on this podcast. All right, I will talk to you guys very soon.